Refinance activity is heating up. Are your originators ready to capture the opportunity? Join Optimal Blue experts Jared Sammy and Brennan O'Connell on October 7th at 1 p.m. Central for a live webinar, Refi Revival: Stay Ahead of the Curve with Originator Intelligence. You'll discover how to surface high-potential refinance leads from your closed loan data, reconnect with past borrowers using timely, data-driven outreach, and cut research time from 30 minutes to just one click. Register now with the link in the show notes for this episode to give your team the edge in quarter four and beyond. In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for timely market analysis and expert commentary from Optimal Blue. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. All right, everybody. Welcome. Today is Monday, June 16th. A lot going on that we want to cover with you today. You know, we always strive to bring you up to the hour current events, and there's some of those going on this week for sure. We'll start with a market update. We'll cover, you know, what went on last week and some previews of some things going on this week, including the Fed meeting, which is probably the big piece of information this Wednesday. We'll touch on, you know, we'll touch on the escalation of the Iran-Israel conflict in the Middle East, of course. Markets seem to be shrugging that off so far, just some energy price shocks, but something to keep an eye on, you know, could certainly bleed over into other parts of the world, bleed into other markets. And we'll talk get a little bit more in depth about some of the conversations we've had surrounding just how awash the world is in debt right now and how that's really contributing to keeping rates high. That means, you know, our own debt, our personal, you know, loans, car loans, credit cards, things like that, but also just the, you know, government debt that's starting to really build and some things that are changing in the dynamics of the world that are causing a lot of governments, including our own in the U.S., to take on more debt and to run up deficits, and how that's ultimately likely to keep rates higher for longer. In the way of data, we saw the OBMMI just still sticky around 6.8. I don't know that it's deviated more than an eighth from that over the past couple of months, but volume is still good. We're still seeing volume healthy in the range of what we would have expected pre-COVID in terms of, you know, number of units or number of loans that are getting originated in the purchase and the refi space. All right, let's transition over to the team and talk a little bit about what's going on in the market. Okay, welcome, James, Alex, Jeff. Let's wrap a little bit today. A lot going on. Even some things that changed our topic list a little bit that happened over late last week and then over the weekend. But why don't we just start with what happened last week in terms of economic numbers, starting with just had some inflation numbers, right? We have yet to see the boogeyman come from tariff worries, right?
Yeah, Jim. So last week was inflation numbers. We got CPI and PPI, and they really built upon a pretty rosy picture that we've been kind of developing the last 2-3 months now. CPI came in right at expectations at 2.4%, and PPI was a little bit under expectations, 2.8% year over year. So it's kind of opening the door, I think, to conversations about if inflation is under control. As we've been talking about for several weeks now, the employment picture seems to be degrading at a not too decent clip. We're approaching that 250,000 new unemployed each week.
So employment picture is fine, right? It's degrading a little bit. The initial claims numbers are getting a little bit worse week over week. But generally, the headline inflation numbers are low. But it feels like some of that was driven by energy prices for a while. Energy prices have quietly been dropping since the beginning of the year. Even some of the metrics that don't include directly energy costs lead into everything, right? It's an input to almost any kind of good or service because goods need to get from point A to point B, or you know, your restaurant has energy bills, this sort of thing, right? But then we have this conflict in the Middle East that's starting to heat up late last week. Like, that could that pull a rug out from under all of this, especially if part of the plan of the new administration was, okay, tariffs come in. On paper, that could raise prices of goods. But then meanwhile, we are getting lower energy prices through things like deregulation and just sort of the natural trajectory of what energy prices had been doing. But now we have this escalation that could that derail all of this, right?
I absolutely has the ability to derail all this if there isn't, you know, an off-ramp for this conflict, which I think we can get into in a little bit more detail. But as you were saying, you know, they always break out these inflation metrics with core and non-core, including volatile classifications such as is energy and food. And if you look at, you know, the past few months, actually core numbers have been lower. So those that exclude fuel have been even lower. So energy's been working in favor of lowering these inflation numbers, as you were saying. And yeah, as late last week, we started seeing a little uptick in violence in the Middle East. We saw a little preliminary strike from Israel onto Iran, and then Iran is currently lobbing missiles back at them. They're going back and forth right now. I think, you know, the G7 conference, they're meeting this week, and that's going to be a major topic for them to just discuss, just keeping everything under wraps and trying to, like I said earlier, just find an off-ramp here, because no one wants a conflagration, and they're on opposite ends of the Middle East, so to say. And so there's a lot of people that could be dragged in.
Honestly, sort of surprising. I mean, it's pretty close to an all-out war from how I'm reading it. So it's almost surprising we haven't seen a larger jump in crude oil prices. We definitely saw a jump over the weekend. It's coming back down today, but maybe people are optimistic. As you said, Alex, it will de-escalate quickly with some of the talks and conversation.
Yeah, as I said, like there is, so Iraq separates Israel from Iran. And so I think that is really what has kept this from becoming a ground war, really, so far as it's been an air war. It's been missiles and planes in the air. So perhaps, you know, we might be slightly blessed by geography here that it's keeping, you know, from expanding into a larger ground war. But I agree with you, Jeff. I think, you know, we saw initially oil prices shot up on Friday, but you know, opening here on Monday, they're right where they were at on Friday. So the markets are seeing so far that it should just be an off-ramp.
Yeah, I mean, the markets don't seem, other than, like you said, oil prices jumping initially and holding those gains, other markets seem to be shrugging this off as if it will be something that de-escalates quickly. And maybe that's, we've been lulled to sleep over the past couple of times that Israel and Iran have lobbed missiles at each other. But I don't know, it does feel a little bit different. It does feel like it wouldn't take much for this to break into something more substantial that would do more than just potentially obstruct the oil routes, right? Which is the typical worry there. It just makes it a little more dangerous to go through some of those already dangerous straits where the oil tankers go. But just that this could pull other countries and resources into a larger war.
With the international shipping staying as it is, so as Israel and Iran are lobbing these missiles back and forth, previously over the decades as Israel's gone to war, Egypt has been a large player. But after Camp David, they have, you know, become much closer, and we have not seen them in the news posing as any sort of threat to Israel immediately. So that does say that the Suez Canal would remain open. And so a lot of trade goods that are going through there, including oil, wouldn't slow down. Meanwhile, Iran, which is a major oil exporter, and Israel, whose largest oil facility was actually struck today, oil is the big shifter here, but the rest of the products are still going through the strait.
Yeah, the strait to be concerned about, I would say, is probably more so the Strait of Hormuz. That's the one that anytime Iran is, you know, angry about the situation in the Middle East, that they'll threaten to shut that. That's, again, a very tight shipping channel that they could easily close themselves. We keep some battle groups stationed there as well to, offset that. But we'll have to see. As you were saying, Jim, we hope that there's an off-ramp. It seems to be an off-ramp, but, that's just what's happened in the past. And some of the rhetoric that's been coming out of both sides has been so-and-so will burn, et cetera, et cetera. It does seem to be a little more...
saber-rattling.
Yeah, a lot more saber-rattling. So we'll definitely have to keep an eye on that. Hopefully, by the time we're recording next week, skies are clear and peace has reigned a little bit more.
Right.
One other note I saw related to energy costs is, this AI boom, of course, is causing an increase in demand for electricity throughout the world, but, throughout our country. That's probably a little bit more of a long-term thing that we need to think about the supply side. Do we have the supply of electricity throughout our country to meet the demand? The article I read, the AI boom is not a cost-free boom. So something interesting to think about. It's actually something that comes up more, I feel like, with perhaps you guys, the younger generation, my nieces and nephews, that talk a lot about it more. So for some reason, it hasn't come up as much thinking about, how costly and how much strain this puts on.
Just the infrastructure.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just going to say, up until the AI boom began, I think America was very much so meeting its own energy needs. We kind of learned our lesson from all the energy shocks going back all the way back to the 70s. The West Texas oil shale that they've been fracking, we've really become fairly self-sufficient in regards to energy. When we see these energy shocks, in regards to the war in Ukraine or instability in the Middle East, a lot of times it's European energy prices that are rocketing up. We're a little more insulated here in the United States in regards to, fossil fuels. As you were saying, though, Jeff, as we're transitioning towards AI and just the massive energy resources that it needs, I think, the average AI search takes, 3-4x the amount of energy that, a Google search previously would have taken. And as people are, as Google rolls out these features where AI is the first thing that comes up, you can kind of say that each Google search is taking 3-4x the amount of energy that they previously did. So I've actually been seeing, a renewed conversation in regards to nuclear energy. I think it was Microsoft made a...
Three Mile Island.
Yeah, Three Mile Island. I think there was also another one somewhere in Illinois, maybe south of Chicago somewhere, that they were planning to reopen. It was a nuclear plant that was going to go defunct, essentially. And they were just planning to reopen that just because they project that the energy needs are not going to be met by conventional fossil fuels or, renewables. So more to come there, I think, as well.
Yeah. Opening or reopening nuclear power plants is what seems to be at least the quickest avenue to significantly spiking the generation of electricity in the U.S. and abroad as well. And is it temporary? I've read some articles about that too. Like, do these programs just get more efficient like anything else, right? So they will not take nearly as much energy in the next decade. So you're building infrastructure for something you may not need. So then other folks would say you need to focus more on renewables that are not nuclear. Anyway, that's definitely a story to keep an eye on, because there's going to be a scrounging for resources, as there always is. And AI is going to be a big player in that game.
So again, all these things, just, other parts of the boogeyman, as you said earlier, what will these rising energy costs lead into the inflation numbers, keep interest rates up, or are we going to see what we saw last week and see these numbers come in lower than what we keep talking about?
Agreed. Still needs to play out. We're still not seeing can't see the effects of tariffs yet. Haven't seen the effects of DOGE on the unemployment numbers yet, but I think, I guess we'll kick that can ahead to July and see what numbers look like then.
Yeah. Credit where credit's due. I think companies have, stocked their warehouses in the lead up to those tariffs pretty sufficiently. We are around that cutoff mark where, even if the warehouses were overflowing with goods, we're probably, approaching the end of those stores, and they will start to see, incremental increases with the tariffs that are currently in place. And then, barring no deals being done beginning in July here, we're going to see those tariffs kick up in effect. So more to come there, as we keep saying. Don't want to keep kicking the can, but more to come.
All right. So this week, other than the Middle East conflict, what should we be watching out for? I mean, there's the Fed meeting Wednesday. That's obviously huge. There won't be a change in rate, but the discussion around where the Fed is leaning currently, what the dot plot looks like, is going to be probably center stage for the rest of this week, right?
Absolutely. Yep. Now you nailed the nail on the head there, Jim. It's do not expect a cut here. Don't expect one at the July meeting either. Really, this one, watch the presser from Powell. you know, see how he responds to the question, lines of questioning. You know, I think that the drama surrounding him and Trump has really subsided, as a lot of domestic politics has in the past, you know, few days. But yeah, they will be releasing a dot plot with this release, just to see, kind of gauge where each of the Fed members are at. This one is well timed. You know, we got, you know, almost the first half's inflation readings. I think it's time to start seeing if the board members agree with us in that, you know, inflation may be subsiding as the main pain point, but I could see them making the opposite argument that, you know, the tariffs introduce too big of a black box, too many question marks in regards to what the inflation picture is going to look like in the latter half of the year. So definitely watch that press conference and just see. Again, we can talk about it all day and what we think and what we're seeing, but at the end of the day, they're the ones that are making the decisions. So lean on their opinion more so than mine.
Yeah, at this point, we'll be halfway through the year, really putting into question whether we see any cuts this year right now, right? I mean, one cut maybe is what's priced into the cards.
Yeah, FedWatch has at least one priced in by end of year. It's if you combine the chances if you're looking at December, it's about 70%, 40% chance of two cuts, 30% chance of one cut. So we are still expecting cuts this year, but at the same time, we were expecting cuts around this time now, and those bets have been pared back quite a bit. So again, we just gotta have to wait for the picture to develop a little bit more before seeing.
All right. Otherwise, not huge numbers coming up this week. We've got retail sales. Obviously, you want to watch for if spending habits have changed at all with the tariff discussions or with employment or with the debt situation.
Yep. Yeah, we're several weeks away from the next major unemployment report, that first Friday of July. But, you know, aside from the weekly unemployment, new unemployment numbers, I think, you know, retail sales is one place we could look. You know, 60% of the economy is retail consumption spending. If we start seeing those numbers being pared back on retail sales, that could tell you, you know, consumers are in a pinch. Consumers are starting to maybe put a little bit more in the bank because they're foreseeing issues down the line. So see if that comes in weeks, see how that's doing. It is the third week of the month. It is a relatively slow week regarding data. We get some building permits, new builds, how those are looking. As we say every month, don't look for that to be us digging ourselves out of the supply hole in regards to housing. But home builders are one of those first to pull back when they see the red flag of the recession waving. So if we see those numbers, you know, drastically decrease, that could be a sign that home builders are pulling back because, again, they don't want to be sitting on inventory that they built, you know, during a bull market during the good times when no one has the money to splurge on a new home.
Right. Otherwise, you know, keep your eye on the initial jobless claims numbers. That's what you can look at week to week between the official unemployment reports. You know, those are, you know, legit numbers that reflect folks that are applying for unemployment benefits. And those have been ticking up week over week slightly. And that's a good indicator of where the job market might be. All right. So what is all of this that we've just talked about, in addition to just some of the fairly major changes in the world that have gone on in the past 6 months, and you can probably even go before that, you know, what do all these things mean in terms of interest rates, especially in the mortgage market, right? We've got consumer debt higher than it's ever been, right? If you look at credit cards or whatever you want to look at, consumers in the U.S. currently have higher debt balances than we've ever had by quite a large margin. And at the same time, you've got delinquencies that are ticking up slightly, but nothing near what we saw during the Great Financial Crisis or anything like that, right? Just sort of a natural escalation in delinquencies that are coming off of the huge amounts of savings that we saw during COVID. And you can also call savings paying off debt, right? Just kind of reducing debt counts as saving. And then, I mean, just to set it up nationally and internationally, governments are running up deficits at a pretty record pace. And some of that has been somewhat recent and somewhat related to some of the, you know, the deglobalization that we've talked about on this podcast before, where you have members of NATO that are now a little bit more worried about protecting themselves rather than other countries kind of coming to protect them or to help in this larger coalition. Just with some of the rhetoric that's gone on, whether it's having to do with tariffs or just generally this general theme of deglobalization over the past years. I don't know. What do you guys think? Like, where do we start to have this conversation?
You might want to start with individuals, right? So as you were alluding to with credit card debt and all this creeping up, I was seeing the numbers. On average, if you were to spread out over every American, everyone has about $6,500 in debt, which, you know, for you and Jeff sitting here, you could take that, you know, pay that off. But if Alex and I were given a $6,500 bill at dinner, I don't really know what I would do with that on a Friday night. It would be an enormous amount to be hit with. So whenever you look at the savings of an average American, those are always kind of scary numbers. What, even as an average, skewed by the upside, how low those numbers can be. $6,500 on everyone's plate is a lot. And that delinquency number, while, you know, it's not 2008, it's not the edge of the world, I saw that if you're 18 to 30, it's about 10%. So that is definitely a number that's been creeping up. And it is something worth kind of looking at. I think it really ties into with student loans, especially that age range, right? 18 to 39, you're paying that off. Most people have, it's about $25,000 in student loans. It's something like 12% of Americans have them. And with the administration rolling back the Biden era pause, there's a lot more people who are tightening their belts and looking at this. So I do think credit card debt, of course, you're seeing more delinquencies. There's a huge payment that people have not been making for the past 4 years that suddenly this age group is having to make again.
Right. Yeah, you've got to start with the individual. You know, we talk about inflation, but then if you talk about how much debt each individual has, and you think about what an interest rate on a credit card is, right? Forget about 7% mortgages. You're talking 20%+. You're paying for that, you know, that carton of eggs costs 40% more than it did a year ago, but you're probably going to pay 60% interest on it because it's going to take you several years to pay it off. So all of this just creates more and more stress on every individual out there.
Yeah. And I think a major example of that pain point in this, you know, pushing people further and further to the margins is, you know, this buy now, pay later, which has really, I think, gained steam in probably the last 2 years. You know, I don't really know of anyone who is using, you know, a payment plan for, you know, those everyday purchases. I guess a credit card, you could think of it almost as it's not, but, you know, some of these buy now, pay later, they function like a credit card. You know, you make payment in full from your bank account to the whoever you bought from in 30 to 45 days, you know, a credit billing cycle. But a lot of these are, they're essentially just short-term consumer loans. You have 2-3 month payment plans, but they go out 24 months is, you know, 2 years to buy. And, you know, a lot of the discourse was around, you know, who's using this for, you know, to buy your Chipotle at the end of the day, you know, you know, there's jokes to be made in there, but also at the same time, like, you know, if this is a real pain that people are feeling, you know, how close to the margins are so many people? And it's just bears, you know, something to think about how much pain is being felt. And as to what James said, how much people are needing to tighten their belts, or they've tightened their belts so much that they don't even have, you know, the ability to pay for those everyday things, and having to rely on a line of credit for that and then pay interest down the line on that is just amplifying the pain, in my opinion. But at the same time, you know, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Relating them to credit cards makes a lot of sense. It's a good example that most people have. But if you go, you know, back, you know, now it's 15 years, but 2008, there were layaway loans, right? You could go in and basically go to Costco and buy a couch and pay it off slowly over time. It's the exact same idea. It's just a different way of doing a loan. And something that I found interesting about, you know, Klarna is the main example of these buy now, pay laters. But if you are failing to pay that, they can hit your credit score. They can report that to the credit companies and that can take you down. But if you are paying perfectly on time, they cannot, there's no reporting there. So you actually can't upwardly push your credit score by taking on these short-term loans, but you can definitely damage it. So there's kind of a risk implicit in doing these buy now, pay later schemes.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that they don't report unless it's a negative report.
Only to the down, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just, it's more debt, it's more delinquency, it's more opportunity for delinquency, and all of these things are going to push rates higher, right? I mean, that's how credit card rates are calculated, is what is Chase or whatever the bank, what do they have to pay in general to cover any losses from delinquent borrowers? So we've got the individual covered, and let's talk again about just international debt. You know, we know that the big, beautiful bill is, at least on paper, running up quite a deficit. You know, we will hit a record deficit again this year, no matter what. The effects of it might be different down the road, but that's on paper. We're gonna borrow a few extra trillion than we're making this year. Then you see that from other countries. We don't hear as much about it here in the US, but if you get out there and you read, you will see that other countries are spending more on things like defense is a huge one. There's also just generally just less socialization of certain costs going on as we deglobalize. I mean, what are you all hearing about that other than just the high level?
I'm a big fan of looking at the scariest website. Have you ever seen the usdebtclock.org? That thing will really keep you up at night. Actually, this is making me laugh. They have a section for Doge. Apparently, you've saved $520 billion. That's a little incredulous to me, but at nearly $37 trillion in debt, the United States is 122% of GDP, maybe even a little bit higher than that. That's definitely a concerning figure. I know we talked about this about a week ago that, you know, when people would talk about the debt, you used to be able to look at it and say like, oh, well, 75, 80% of GDP, you know, we're nowhere near, you know, name a Soviet bloc country. Like we can compare and it still looks good. At 122, we are among the worst. And it's definitely a frightening thing to look at. You know, it doesn't feel like we're moving towards making those austerity moves that would cut this down. It feels like we're attempting to grow our way out of it. But with the interest on the debt being about as high as we pay for the military, which is a notoriously large number in America, it seems difficult to think that we could really grow our way out of this and not have to make some cuts somewhere.
Some sacrifices. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's $1 trillion we're spending on just debt service, right? So that alone, just the debt that's already out there, we're going to increase that number. And to do that, we will have to issue more debt. And there's not necessarily more buyers out there, more demand for this debt. So we just keep going deeper below GDP. And I'm with you. And we've talked about it before where you used to be able to take comfort in looking at numbers and say, yes, we have a record amount of debt, but we're the largest economy in the world. And as a percentage of our economy, it's relatively low. That you can't say that anymore. Now we're definitely, you know, borrowing more than what we're making as a nation. And we are up there with some countries that are notoriously just in a bad spot, like Greece, right? That have the countries that have actually defaulted before. We are not in a spot, you know, it does not feel like we're in a spot where we could literally default, but just the fact that so much supply is coming online, so much debt needs to be financed, that rates at this point, it doesn't feel realistic that rates go, that it, like the 30-year mortgage goes below 6.5%. Certainly not below 6. I'll call that. We've been calling it, but I don't see how it's possible without some sort of major intervention, like from the Fed, which could happen, but they'd have to have a real good reason, like a really brutal unemployment picture or a major dislocation in markets. Even, I don't know that a war at this point, a much larger scale war than what we're seeing, I don't know that would put a dent in interest rates. Could even make them worse because defense spending across the globe continues to increase. Anyway, we're not painting the rosiest picture, but I think we're all pretty realistic about rates at this point, and that's what we're looking at. You know, if anyone who's still wondering at home, why are rates stubbornly high and how long is it going to be that way? I mean, that's basically the answer, is there's not a reason for rates to drop and they'll probably stay here or go higher over the next 5+ years.
Yeah. Tying it back to the inflation numbers. I mean, there's so many other things out there besides just the raw inflation numbers that are going to keep those rates stubbornly high. So
the amount of debt coming online this year, the amount of debt that needs to be refinanced this year, I'll play into the picture. And then just every year that we don't address the debt issue, every year that we kick the can on that, it narrows the options available to us. We've talked about austerity on this call today. And at a certain point, even austerity won't cut it. As James said, you know, a lot of the times the debt is pitched as, you know, it'll grow the economy in some way, shape or form. And sometimes some of that debt absolutely does. Some of that debt does not. Some of it is wasteful spending. But at the same time, like I said, every year that we kick the can on this and don't address it and keep living, you know, the high life, which you know, come back to the personal, you know, living on debt like that, living beyond your means, you're living the high life. But at a certain point, you know, you'll come down to reality. I think the one thing to keep in mind that's different between you and I and our credit cards and the U.S. government is the U.S. government issues their currency. So default is, you know, I think we said that word one time. Default is in the case of a sovereign that is, you know, publishing their own currency, it's default is a political decision, not a financial decision, because you can always print your way out if you're a sovereign. But that is a very scary thing to do. That's not what anyone wants to do. And it would absolutely dramatically change the economic landscape of the entire planet. Because when we're talking about the United States, we're talking about the US dollar system, which has been, you know, the bedrock of the global economy since 1945. Like I said, there's limited options and none of them are great. I just hope we can come to our senses sooner rather than later.
Agreed. Well summed up, honestly. Yeah. Yeah, the dollar, maybe we'll do a whole episode on the dollar. I mean, that's the status of the dollar as the reserve currency across the globe has been called into question more than I've seen in my lifetime just over the past 6 months. You can see it with the price of gold going up and generally the US dollar weakening versus other currencies. It's, again, some of that is deglobalization. Some of it is taking on too much debt. So yeah, a story we will continue to follow and share with all of you. All right, gang. Great discussion today. Thanks for the time. Thanks for the wisdom, and we'll do it again soon. Okay, let's wrap this thing up. Thanks so much, Alex, Jeff, James. Great conversation today, as always. Moving forward, we will continue to keep you all informed about what's going on. But that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.